There is some discrepancy here, folks, okay? We can't have 50% of voting age people voting when 90%+ of people consider them thieves, pedophile, crooks, scumbags.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Boiling Frogs Post Roundtable. I am your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and today we are joined, of course, as always, by the BFP founder and editor, Sibel Edmonds in Oregon. We are also joined today by Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, and we are also joined by Wayne Madsen of the Wayne Madsen Report, who I'm sure will be familiar to a lot of listeners and viewers out there, but if not, we will direct you to everyone's respective websites in a moment. First, let's talk about what we are going to be talking about today. For those who have not been following our coverage at BoilingFrogsPost.com about the Dennis Hastert scandal and the cover-up of that scandal, I highly suggest you take a look at the information that's been compiled so far at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And the best place to do that would be the all-in-one encompassing article that has links to all of the coverage that we've done so far, all of the articles, podcasts, and videos that have been done. It's called The People's Campaign, The Real Hastert Case, All in One Place. And I will, of course, provide the link to this in the show notes for this video. So wherever you're watching this on YouTube or Boiling Frogs Post or my website, the link will be there to this article so you can go and catch up on the Dennis Hastert case and what it entails. It's a very, very large web. So we have a lot of people here to break it down and discuss what's really going on with this. We're going to start with Wayne Madsen, as he is new to the program, the roundtable here. And Wayne, first of all, can you throw out your website for people?
Oh, it's WayneMadsenReport.com. That's all together. No dashes, hyphens. So it's WayneMadsenReport.com.
Excellent. Okay, again, the link to all of our respective websites will be in the show notes as well. So, Wayne, let's start with you talking about this Dennis Hastert case. First of all, how did Hastert come on your radar, and what was it that you were able to uncover about his activities a decade ago?
Well, there were two news streams going on at the time, not at the same time. The first was the Mark Foley scandal. Mark Foley was a Republican congressman from Florida, who resigned after it was discovered that he was engaging in illicit sexual activity with underage male pages in the House. That was not the only scandal. These scandals with House pages seem to have erupted about, give or take a few years, every 10 years. There was one at the end of the 1970s, early 80s. There was another one involving pages and midnight tours of the White House at the latter part of Reagan, the first part of the George H.W. Bush administration. And then we had this Foley scandal coming after that. So, Foley, it wasn't just Foley, because what was going on with Foley is they were covering up for Foley, and one of the cover-up people was the then Speaker Dennis Hastert, and the Republican leadership included guys like New York Congressman Tom Reynolds and their senior staffers. And when Foley got caught, then there was all this, like, it was almost like musical chairs. They were shifting people around, chiefs of staff and senior staffers. But finally, it caught up with Foley, and he resigned. But at that time, I started hearing about the unusual relationship that Dennis Hastert had with his own chief of staff, and that there was basically sort of a gay mafia that was first tried to protect Foley, and then basically had to throw him to the wolves because he was about ready to bring the whole House of Cards down. And this involved, like I say, this involved people like Tom Reynolds and one interesting story I got was, it was Valentine's Day, and a well-known Washington reporter was flying from Chicago to National Airport in Washington and noticed that Mrs. Hastert, Dennis Hastert's wife, was on the plane. And this reporter inquired, "Oh, you're coming to stay spend Valentine's Day with the speaker. She says, "Oh no, when I go, you know, every time I come to Washington, I'll be at a hotel. This, you know, my husband, he lives in a townhouse with, you know, the chief of staff." And she indicated they weren't even going to get together on Valentine's Day, which it's anecdotal, but I think gets to the point that, you know, here's Dennis Hastert, who's like sponsoring all kinds of legislation for family values. And that certainly wasn't your normal Ozzie and Harriet relationship there, you know. So that was going on. And then I, when this guy John Mark Carr was arrested in Thailand, and he actually admitted that he killed JonBenet Ramsey, the girl in Colorado who was like six or seven, and he didn't. And when I went to Southeast Asia, and what I discovered was a huge pedophile network operating out of embassies, including the American embassy. John Mark Carr taught English to young kids, junior high age and younger. And what he was basically doing, and he got caught in a sting by the new military government in Thailand that overthrew the democratically elected prime minister. And the new prime minister was a general who was a Muslim from the south, and he actually had a mandate to crack down on pedophiles. So he put the word out, and the police nabbed John Mark Carr basically in a sting where he was trying to procure kids. So the question was, who's he procuring the kids for? Now, he had a penchant for young girls, but he was procuring these underage girls and boys for visiting VIPs at the American Embassy in Bangkok. And the CIA basically went to Carr and said, "Look, the only way we're going to get you out of here is you got to plead. You got to say you killed JonBenet Ramsey. There's going to be such an outrage in the international media that the Thais won't have any choice but to release you to Boulder, Colorado, to face those charges." If you recall, there was a photograph of John Mark Carr on the flying business class drinking a glass of champagne when he was supposed to be sort of under arrest, being taken back to the United States, and people thought that was outrageous. So he's flown to LAX. The state of Colorado sent an executive jet to pick him up. He goes to Boulder. The district attorney there, Mary Lacey, gets him and says, "Oh, you didn't kill JonBenet Ramsey. We got to let you go." And so he's free and clear. Even though there was in Santa Rosa, California, there was a case against him when he was a school teacher of him possessing child pornography. The hard disk containing the evidence somehow walked out of the evidence room in Santa Rosa. And so he's free and clear now. So the whole thing was to get him out of Thailand, because if they got him on a stand in Thailand, it would have been very, very embarrassing for the United States. And I recall talking to a very senior State Department official about this, who had responsibility at the time for human trafficking, including child sex trafficking, who basically said, you realize that this could not have occurred at the embassy without the involvement of the U.S. ambassador. And I said, well, it did involve the U.S. ambassador. And it wasn't just... So when I started looking at these VIPs, I looked at these congressional delegations called CODELs. Hastert, who used to complain because he was very, you know, he's very heavy, he was very heavy. He complained about the two-hour flight from National to Midway in Chicago. But he had no problems on several occasions getting on flights to Hanoi, Bangkok, and Yangon in Myanmar on these CODELs. He also went to Saipan on some of those, and that's, of course, a sweatshop that Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff were involved with. And there was also trafficking of kids there to that U.S. territory, Northern Marianas. So so you put the two together, and then when I go to Chicago, I start saying, well, what do we know about Hastert? You know, what kind of guy is he? He's, you know, he's a Speaker of the House. And then I started hearing from knowledgeable people that when he was a wrestling coach at Yorkville High School back in the late 60s, he was basically let go because of kids coming back and saying there was improper touching going on and other things going on with him as a wrestling coach. And then an opportunity opened in the Illinois House of Representatives where ex-coach Hastert, ex-teacher Hastert decides, because somebody died, some Republican died, they decide to run him for the House of Representatives in the state of Illinois. He wins, and then there's another opening for the Illinois Senate. He wins that election, and this is how we eventually get Speaker of the House, Hastert. Recall, he only became Speaker as a result of another sex scandal, one, you know, pretty mundane. Robert Livingston, who replaced Newt Gingrich after he resigned, resigned after he had to admit to infidelity in his marriage, and that was right after they tried to impeach Bill Clinton. So you might say that Hastert had kind of a lucky political career because he should have been caught at many different times, but he kind of snuck through. And I was actually pretty surprised when they indicted him for paying the hush money. I wasn't surprised that he did it. I was surprised that they indicted him for it.
Absolutely. And just to be clear and connect these dots for people, so Dennis Hastert, you're saying, is part of those delegations that were going to Thailand and other places for the child sex trafficking through the embassy.
Yeah, it was not just that. I mean, you got to look at both what he was doing on congressional delegations, but also what he was doing in the House in a leadership position, because there was cases involving guys like Jim Colby from Arizona, Republican. He came out and said he was gay, but there were an unusual case where he had taken underage pages to Arizona for like the 4th of July weekend on a camping trip. And that was brought up to the House Ethics Ethics Committee. And every time you saw one of these members of Congress, I got to say, in every case, as far as I know, they were all Republicans. But, you know, family value type. I mentioned Foley. Foley was the head of the caucus on missing and exploited children. I mean, this is how in your face these people get. Hastert was sort of like the person I think they look to. As long as Denny Hastert is a speaker or he's in a senior position in the House leadership, we this sort of underlying network of pederasts had nothing to worry about.
And I will point out once again, just for people, as I pointed out in my video on this subject, you were reporting on this at least as far back as 2006, mm-hmm. if not earlier. So, and that's on the record that you were already reporting on this. So this is not new information you're just coming up with after the scandal broke. You were on it a decade ago.
I got to say, when I first reported it, the reaction, of course, from the corporate press in Washington was like, you know, I mean, you know, once they stopped laughing, it was like, you know, you got to be kidding. It's shocking sometimes that the corporate press in Washington doesn't seem to get it about these people. But after covering D.C. for as long as I have, some of these journalists go to the same social events that these pederasts go to. So they're worried that it's going to come back to them. I've always suspected them. I know many people, and you see their faces on TV still all the time, would never report it because it's very close to home for them.
And I'd like to add just a little bit about the history. Going back to the 1980s, there was a scandal involving a savings and loan in Nebraska called Franklin. And Nick Bryant is a really courageous journalist who has revealed how the people who ran Franklin, was a guy named Larry King, not the TV guy, not the boxing guy, and Larry King was trafficking boys from Boys Town to political parties in Washington, D.C. And there was a whole group of people who were part of the Reagan administration who participated in those parties. It was just astounding. And more recently, Nick Bryant co-authored a book with Henry Vinson called Confessions of a DC Madam. Vinson is a gay mortician who operated an escort service in DC, and some of his clients were Republicans. In the book, there's a sequence where they describe how one Republican administration official who had been a longtime CIA officer, had been promoted to ambassador, was caught and exposed for being at one of these parties, and the parties were used to blackmail people like that. And Vinson reports that a high-ranking cabinet official in the then George H.W. Bush administration paid him a visit with veiled threats, and ultimately Henry Vinson did two tours in federal prison that were pretty clearly intended to keep him quiet. Now, what is interesting about our current discussion is I've asked Vinson and Bryant point blank, was Dennis Hastert involved in either of those rings, either the Franklin or the DC Madam? And he said no, which I found surprising, frankly.
That is surprising. That's interesting. And sorry, I just realized I didn't properly introduce you to the listeners, Peter. So Peter B. Collins of peterbcollins.com. Let's turn to Sibel Edmonds, boilingfrogspost.com. How does what we've heard so far square up with your firsthand knowledge of what the FBI was looking at in these cases?
Well, some of these facts presented here, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of. But what I know has to do with what the Department of Justice and the FBI had been collecting between 1996, this is late 1996, and that was the case when I was fired from the FBI in April 2002. So I can vouch for this time period. I don't know if it went on. I suspect that it did. But between 1996 and 2002, per direct directive from the White House, and this was during Clinton's scandals with Lewinsky and Jones, the FBI's counterintelligence unit was given an order to collect information using FISA and ELSR under FBI's counterintelligence on political figures in Congress and start establishing specific files on them. Now, the agents in the FBI referred to this as COINTELPRO 2. Now, whether the directive was titled or named as such or not, I'm not sure, but I know that they were trying to hide behind this noble purpose that it was Clinton's intention to show that he's coming down really hard on corruption and crime, especially those involving government officials. And so what happened during this time in this particular program, they collected tons of information on people like Dennis Hastert, Bob Livingston, Roy Blunt, Dan Burton. But I have to say that in this particular case, it was not limited to one party, because since they were sucking in information from multiple methods, it was, think of a vacuum. The vacuum is not going to pick up a particular dust particles. It was sucking in information on all of them. And they used some of this information. That's why Bob Livingston stepped down. That's how the impeachment kind of was put aside in many ways. But also by 2000, they realized that they had too much dirt on people from their side of aisle, and people such as in this case, we had Bob Creamer in Chicago, who served several high-level officials in Illinois. They had Stephen Solars. They had Tom Lantis. They had Jan Schakowsky, who was married to Bob Cremer. And so anyhow, I am aware of all sorts of files being collected and these people being under surveillance by the Justice Department. But during the same period, these people, they took congressional junkets. They went to Morocco, they went to Turkey, they went to Southeast Asia, as Wayne just referred to. They were, during their junket trip, some of these individuals, they were engaged in, they received sexual favors, gifts from host countries, companies in the host countries that they visited. And in some cases, some of them used little boys. Hastert was among those people. Some of them liked little girls. And the CIA, through State Department, were recording, because they were also monitoring these people. So CIA was recording these people in one of the top hotels that Hastert and others frequented when they went for junket trips, and also other trips, was Chiron Palace in Istanbul. And particular rooms where these VIP guests stayed were always bugged. And sometimes they were monitored and recorded by more than one entities. Those people who are familiar with my book, The Lone Gladio, and James, I know you read that. These specifics are all in there. And some things that may seem comical are very factual and realistic. You had certain cases where foreign hosts, or here in this country, a foreign lobby group or a criminal network would be recording Dennis Hastert's particular townhouse slash office, one of his three offices in Illinois, while at the same time, CIA was recording what was happening in that particular townhouse, while the FBI people in their surveillance van would be outside this townhouse, and they would be monitoring, surveilling Dennis Hastert. So Dennis Hastert, for example, in this case, and he was not the only one, was being recorded, monitored. All this evidence was being gathered by foreign entities, foreign lobby, foreign criminal networks, FBI, DOJ, and the CIA.
So it was not exactly a secret what was happening.
No. Not within the FBI counterintelligence unit. It absolutely was not. But I really need to clarify something. The agents that I worked with, the counterintelligence agents, they really wanted to get this guy. I mean, they initially believed, honestly believed, that they were doing all this so they could get what they referred to as bastards and creeps like this and put them behind bars. So it was, hooray, Clinton, we're going to do this. They didn't know until 2001 that it actually started in late 1999 when the FBI agents started saying, we have enough. We have enough to put Dennis Hastert in jail, Stephen Soler. Some of these people were engaged in direct espionage. But then the Clinton administration, Janet Reno's excuse was, well, all this evidence on these individuals were collected illegally by abusing FISA. Think about the forbidden tree. Therefore, they could not use this in criminal courts. And that was completely BS. But the agents, until that point, they believed that they were going to put, this was going to be bigger than Watergate. They were going to put all these people in jail. And then in 2001, George Bush administration, around January 2002, they officially shut down that operation that was trying to get this information into the criminal bucket. You had the counterintelligence bucket, the criminal bucket, and that's when they came and they shut down the process of transferring it from one bucket to another.
Well, of course, this raises the question, if these FBI agents were so passionate about this, then how come they haven't stepped forward to this point to talk about that? And we will get back to that question in a moment. But just on a technical note, how did the FBI know about what the CIA was doing in its surveillance in foreign countries? Were they sharing that information?
No. Well, CIA was not sharing. FBI's counter-espionage unit always shared information. For example, they would know that, and then when you get back to how they knew about it, these passionate agents, I will get into that. But in one particular case, it was Dennis Hastert through his conduit, Palmer, Scott, Scotty, that's how he was always referred to, Scotty, they also provided top secret information to foreign networks, not only lobby, but criminal networks, because Hastert's office was cleared. They had clearance. They had top secret clearance. Same thing with Scotty, okay, so that they could go into these skiffs and listen to the intelligence briefings, etc. Well, they were also giving out to foreign governments, foreign entities, top secret documents. So FBI's counter-espionage unit was also sharing this information with the CIA. It was not the other way around. It was just by... when you surveil people, and this was the FBI, you also know who were the people going and doing things inside that house, and they knew who was the CIA or which operations belonged to the CIA, but the sharing went one way. While the FBI shared, CIA and State Department, they never did. So it was a one-way street.
All right. Okay, we've laid a lot of the cards out on the table, and of course there are a lot of questions that come up with regard to this, and one that I just brought up, so why don't we explore that, is the question of the FBI agents who knew about this, were incensed about what was going on, were convinced this was going to be used for criminal investigation, and then it all got shut down, and, well... have we heard a peep from them? There was, of course, Gilbert Graham that was mentioned in my video report on this and that you've talked about before. Let's talk about the Gilbert Graham case, what he was alleging and what he was incensed about, and why there have not been more Gilbert Grahams stepping forward from that era.
Sure. Gilbert Graham actually worked for the same unit I was working for, and he was part of counterintelligence management, so he was a full-blown agent, veteran agent. And he, once they found out, the FBI agents, including Gilbert Graham, that it was not going to be for prosecution, once they realized that the Clinton administration, they were using this and blackmailing, they were leaking it to Larry Flint, they were leaking it to the other media, and it was only for blackmail and exposure purpose, not to go to court with these things, and the fact that they had people from the Democratic side that they had dirt on, they really got disillusioned. Of course, as we know, many people, they don't blow the whistle initially because my retirement or I'm working and I have kids. The first thing Gilbert Graham did the year he was retiring, he went to the Justice Department's Inspector General's office and filed a full report complaint that he, as the agent in charge of this particular counterintelligence operation, knew that the FBI abused ELSR law, electronic surveillance, and FISA laws for solely for the purpose of gathering dirt on elected officials, and that that is completely illegal. Now, looking at it, how in the world do you go and file that kind of a complaint with the Justice Department? The order came from the Justice Department to start with. It was Janet Reno. But he did in order to go on record. We later obtained what he filed, which is signed, which is sealed, the redacted version of it. And so that's one person. And as you know, Vanity Fair in 2005, September, October of 2005, published a 7-page article on Dennis Hastert. Okay, it was on Sabelle Edmonds, but also exposing Dennis Hastert. The part that dealt with Dennis Hastert came from at least five other government witnesses, okay? Vanity Fair is a mainstream medium, okay? It's not alternative media. They have a legal department with a budget much bigger than all four of us put together here, okay? So they knew that they could not publish an article exposing a sitting active Speaker of the House with all these facts that they were given to and not get sued. So they went beyond reasonable degrees to chop certain things, to triple check. There's a fact-checking process in journalism. They fact-check before it goes to print. In this case, in this article they published, they triple fact-checked meaning they did it, and then a week later, another person came and interviewed witnesses again, five other witnesses from the government. And at the time, some of them were still working for the government, some of them were outside the government, had already retired, and they published this piece. All fact-checked. And the sexual stuff didn't get in there because of the legal issues, but the financial stuff, the fact that Dennis Hastert was getting foreign bribery, Dennis Hastert was engaged in money laundering, suitcases of cash, and Dennis Hastert didn't sue. They didn't even really issue denial. It was this non-denial denial. The Dennis Hastert's attorney in 2005 said, well, Vanity Fair is not presenting the recordings that the FBI had. And they did not challenge, they did not deny it. It had 1.5 million circulation, Vanity Fair expose. Their magazine has 1.5 million circulation. And at the time, Dennis Hastert was the Speaker of the House, guys. And guess what? Washington Post didn't cover it. New York Times didn't cover it. Chicago Tribune, not a single publication in Illinois covered it. Vanity Fair, mainstream media, triple checks, publishes a 7-page article with 6+ witnesses on a current, at the time, active Speaker of the House. Why the nation's media, and that's from both sides of the aisles, Democrats and Republicans, suddenly went silent on that?
That's the question, isn't it? Well, I think
so these people went to Vanity Fair and they got disgusted, okay? They got disgusted because they put their necks out there to do that, right? Nothing happened. Bunch of those people, they said, I mean, really, they said, damn this majority, damn this people, they don't care. I mean, we are giving them the Speaker of the House, okay? Nothing happened. In 2009, I testified under oath and I gave more detail, including the townhouse that Wayne knows about with Dennis Hastert. And I got into the sexual activities. This is 2009, okay? I ended up writing a book, the whole book, my fiction book. There is a section that deals with these issues. Really, it had to be fictionalized. And yet 2015 comes, this supposed little mini scandal breaks, and you don't see a single publication, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, New York Times, tying the case to Vanity Fair article that had been already vindicated, validated under oath testimonies, Wayne Madsen's article. You don't see a single one of these publications doing that. Ask yourself why. Why wouldn't they are supposedly writing about Hastert's indictment, the fact that he's a thief, that the fact that once upon a time he was a pedophile, then he got cured, went to Congress, and stopped screwing kids. And the same publications, they do not mention all the relevant facts from the past, the fact that it was always out there, but the media covered it up as well as other players. And I would like to hear your take, why the media from both sides, the liberal, so-called liberal media, Democrats, and the right-wing media has been going about covering up the known facts about Dennis Hastert.
Any takers on that question?
I'll jump in, but you go ahead, Wayne. I will defer to you.
I was just going to say, to answer Peter's question about the Franklin scandal and the Vinson connection to that, the reason why Dennis Hastert wouldn't have come up in that one is, in those days, he was not a senior congressman from Illinois. As a matter of fact, if you were going to target, in other words, the Franklin group, these were the elite. I mean, these were like, you got the national security advisor to the vice president of the United States. You've got the vice president of the United States involved, George H.W. Bush. You've got senior people in the media at the time, including, somebody that keeps writing books and based on his experiences at Watergate and bringing down Richard Nixon at the Washington Post. I won't mention any names, but I think you know who I'm talking about. He's got a new book out now. They said it's different than all the rest. Gee, it must have footnotes in it if it's different than all the rest. But anyway, The guy who they would have targeted in those days would have been Bob Michael, who was the House Minority Leader for the Republicans, and he was the dean, of course, of the Illinois delegation. So Hastert in those days was just one congressman. I'm not saying he wasn't involved in all this, but he hadn't achieved the notoriety and the sort of the seniority that he would have been invited to, you know, these high-level functions, you know, because you had, you know, the pages, the kids out of Boys Town. They were trafficking kids in from other countries on Air Force planes, landing at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha and then being scattered to who knows where. You give an example, in the early 80s when they had this other page scandal, come up. There was several Republicans named. It was actually on the leading story on both ABC News and NBC News. Frank Reynolds at ABC led with it, and Roger Mudd at NBC at the time led with it. And they had fingered a Maryland congressman named Bob Bauman, Republican, but also a little-known Idaho congressman named Larry Craig. Now, Larry Craig got the message. He wasn't indicted, of course, but his name, of course, denied it. So he, of course, he knows not to get involved in the Franklin thing because, you know, they're looking at him. And he's, you know, so he's relegated to trying, you know, trolling the men's room at Minneapolis St. Paul Airport. So I think it depends on the scandal. And if somebody's already been sort of outed in the media, you're probably not going to find them in, you know, involved in these, you know, other things. So Hastert, of course, when he becomes speaker, then he gets on the radar screen. So I think that's why you don't find his name back in the late 80s or early 90s time frame. Again, the media, liberal conservative, doesn't matter, liberal conservative media, it's the corporate media in Washington, D.C. They go to the same parties, they go to the same receptions, they socialize with the same politicians they're supposed to be covering, and it doesn't work. Yeah, that's not what the Fourth Estate is supposed to be doing. You don't get so close to the people you're covering that you become part of the problem. And I think in many cases, the names, as a matter of fact, the names that came out in the Vincent book media were, you know, these people were the anchors of major television investigative news programs from ABC Nightline, you know, and it goes on and on. So that's why these stories never seem to see the light of day. The media is complicit, totally.
Now, I can understand that once somebody goes to one of these parties or is surveilled with a male escort or with an underage child, they're compromised. And then, you know, whoever is in control of that information can use that to control or manipulate those individuals. But, Sibelle, to your point, Dennis Hastert is a washed-up member of Congress. He is a former speaker, but he is not highly respected, and he has become, or was, until this scandal surfaced, a highly paid lobbyist, like so many, cashing in on his connections on the Hill. But it still does not explain why, for example, the Chicago Tribune, because, you know, they would have no use for him, assuming that the Tribune or anybody else had used this information for leverage. And so it really begs the question, why would the corporate media protect someone who is no longer of any political value? And let me bring it to the present tense, because most recently, the California congressman who was supposed to be replacing John Boehner as speaker, Kevin McCarthy, at the very last minute, withdrew. Now, that is tied to the issues about him blurting out on Fox News that the Benghazi investigation is political and intended to drive down Hillary's numbers. But the media danced around the information that is available to anybody who entered the name Kevin McCarthy and the word affair into a search engine. I got 1,080,000 results when I did a search like that. And it is an open secret in Washington that Kevin McCarthy has a 3 or 4 year running affair with a congresswoman named Renee Elmer. And yet Walter Jones published a kind of vague warning about skeletons in the closet the day before McCarthy withdrew from consideration as speaker. But most outlets in the corporate media have failed to report the clear information that is not a secret that Kevin McCarthy, who is a family values married man, has been having an affair with a family values married woman who's a member of Congress. And so, you know, what is it that drives the salacious tabloid intentions of our corporate media when they get a hold of Caitlyn Jenner or a Kardashian or, you know, sex tapes by some celebrity? They have no restraints about exploiting that kind of very intimate material on people who, you know, have questionable value. I don't really care what the Kardashians are doing, but an elected official who's engaged in all kinds of sexual exploits is vulnerable to blackmail, and that is more of a concern than their personal morality or the hypocrisy that they demonstrate on a daily basis. All of this is fodder for a media that is hungry for sexual material, and yet they won't touch it in these cases that we're talking about.
James, let's hear from you.
Well, I agree, of course, with that analysis, and I think the answer should be self-evident that the duty of the corporate press is to protect the system itself, and I think the Hastert scandal threatens the systemic game that's being played here, which is why it isn't covered. And I say that in the sense that if it could be confined completely and totally to just Hastert, then there is a chance that, yes, many parties would pile on and they'd get the hay out of salacious headlines. But obviously this case touches on way too many people, spread over way too much of the political spectrum, and too many people involved that would have known, should have known, did know, why didn't you cover this 10 years ago? Those types of questions would start to come up, and that would be uncomfortable for too many people, which is why I think, again, I'm sure there are reporters out there and journalists who are interested in getting their teeth into this in the same way there are FBI agents who are interested in getting their teeth into this, but the editorial control obviously comes from the ownership and of these organizations in the top, and I'm sure that the word goes out. I mean, I don't know. I don't have first-hand knowledge of this, but that's my understanding of how this works.
Here is my real shock or disappointment, and that is we are way into this internet era age, and I really thought that this was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that things were going to start to change. Because, look, James, you and I have been doing these video reports, podcasts, right? Articles. This thing is called social media, social networking, Twitter, Facebook, etc. What I don't understand is even using these channels and mediums and communicating directly with the people who have stakes in this, okay, this is about them. This is about their so-called representatives. This is about their so-called justice system that they believe in. This is about people they go every 2 years and vote for. That is the part, but yeah, we know about corporate media, but you would think people being exposed to this through all these mediums that we use and we bring to them this information in the platter, on the platter, and say, here you go. Sometimes we even chew them, James, and it's like, you don't even have to chew it. Look, we made it all in one place so you don't have to click more, and we are giving you this and that, so all you have to do is just chew your gum, watch it, and everything is there, right? All right, why that is not working as we had expected? To me, that is the real dilemma, saying, Because if that works, believe me, then there will be a pressure even in those on those people in corporate media to say this is just getting way too embarrassing and obvious. But we have not gotten anywhere near that point. And why is that?
And Sibel, let me ask you, because ever since the Hastert story broke, and even when you were out of the country, you have been providing, in a very courageous manner, important information, background, about all these things we're discussing. So it's been now 4.5 months. Have any mainstream reporters contacted you and expressed an interest and then said, oh, I'd love to run this story, but it got spiked? Or my boss said, you should go talk to Caitlyn Jenner. Don't be pursuing this story about Dennis Hastert.
Oh, yeah, that's a good analogy. I'm glad you brought it up. Only one, Peter. I'll have to go and dig up his name. He's the lead reporter for CNBC. Actually, he kept emailing me while I was overseas, and I ended up going and getting a disposable phone, having him call that number, which I ended up paying for because that's how it works, you know, when you're overseas with that phone. And I said, go listen to the testimony I provided so we will save time. He's like, yes, I listened to that and I read the Vanity Fair article and I gave him additional information. For example, I gave an additional information on Hastert and for his wife and him, they own a house, big, expensive house. Hastert hasn't lived there he shows up there for Thanksgiving and Christmas. He hasn't lived there, I would say, since 1999, okay? And he has several offices in Illinois within his district. One of them is a combination, and I know the exact address. Anyhow, I provide this guy, and I said, find out who owns this house, okay? Because Hastert is not even paying rent, okay? He doesn't own Hastert. And this guy used to work for the CIA, all right? And anybody goes into it can find out about this guy. And he's giving that house free, and the house that is bugged by several entities where he was screwing underage boys, okay? So I give him this information. Actually, he goes and finds a guy, the fact that he used to be part of the CIA, his name, and he gets confirmation, the CNBC guy, if that jerk is watching right now, okay? He gets confirmation that, yeah, he did not accept money from Hastert because he was doing it as a favor and he did not see anything wrong. And he never personally with his own eyes witnessed anything happening with minors. That was his answer. I said, okay, well, you have my testimony. You have Vanity Fair, the conversation. He said, well, the whole thing is I went to the FBI and they are unwilling to confirm what you're saying. They're not denying it, okay? They are saying no comments, okay? These FBI counterintelligence unit information, we're not going to share. We're not going to say one way or another. But they are not saying this is crazy. Then he says, we were planning to have this big coverage, but we are going to do it if you, Sibel Edmonds, provide us, CNBC, with pictures of Hastert as he's screwing boys, videotapes of Hastert's screwing boys, audio tapes of Hastert and or audios of Hastert, or people who were there and they were seeing him receiving suitcases of cash in that particular townhouse and screwing boys who are going to go on the record and say, yes, we were present. After 2 hours of phone calls, wasting my time, costing me money, after getting all this confirmation, including the background information that I gave this guy for CNBC, he comes and says, we would do it if you hand over all the sex videotapes and everything to us.
Yeah, that, like you and that's, on a flash drive.
And that's the only one, Peter. Nothing from Chicago Tribunes or anything else. It's just that's the only one contact from the mainstream media I had. And this is exactly how it was resulted. You know, I have his email address. He started the inquiry. He contacted first my previous attorneys in D.C. And they contacted me, kept sending emails saying, this reporter wants to talk to you. He's good one. He's not like the rest. I have been told that like 1,000 times. And you would think, I tell my husband, I say, I would never, ever, ever fall for it again. And I fell for it again, and I paid by, you know, real money. It's not only my time. And then the guy says, give me all the tapes, and then we'll run it. I mean, this is just amazing.
Well, let's get to the more, I think, interesting aspect of this that you raised earlier, Sibel, which is, okay, we understand why there are interests in the corporate media that aren't going to touch this with the 10-foot pole, but there are people in the public who have a direct stake in this, people who voted for Hastert, let alone just the general population of the United States, let alone concerned people all around the world, like Canadians living in Japan, who are interested in this and should be outraged, one would think. Why are they not outraged? And I think there's a lot of different ways to approach this question. I would separate it into the two categories. I mean, we're obviously on BoilingFrogsPost.com talking to the irate minority, which is a certain class group of people. And then, of course, there's the sort of unwashed masses, I guess, who you know, whatever, chew their bubblegum and think about Caitlyn Jenner. And I don't want to put it in elitist terms like that, but I think we can differentiate two groups of people like that. So looking at the mainstream sort of audience and their reception of this, I think it's instructive to look at ways that scandals involving power and power structures always tend to go over with the public, which is, I mean, look at, for example, the Cosby allegations and the way that it's so detached from people's sort of everyday reality and their image of this person that it becomes, there's a defense mechanism that kicks in that people will go, oh, it's just, these women are just trying to make money off of this, or they're trying to get their fame and fortune out of this, you know, when it's 9 or 10 women that are accusing, and then there's 20, and then there's 30, and then there's 47, or whatever it is now. Maybe there's a point at which people will finally go, oh, okay, you know, I guess he is that. And I think it's that question of having enough evidence to put it over the top in that way, because let's put it back to what the CNBC reporter was saying. Show us the pictures, show us the video, sure, we'll believe it then. When it's a case that's constructed from different witnesses in different places, people will just go, oh, Sibel, you're just trying to make a name for yourself. And I mean, it's a tough thing to counter without that hard evidence that you just shove in people's face.
This is the reason we are not going to see many whistleblowers, because people have learned a lesson. And if you go and talk to the real whistleblowers, I'm not talking about these pseudo ones in the pockets of this billionaire or that billionaire or Soros foundations, etc. They would tell you, I mean, if you really have a heart-to-heart with them, they would tell you who screwed them the most and the worst and who really slapped them in the face. They're not going to say, oh, after 20 years, my boss is taking away my retirement, or the U.S. media that much, or the Congress not doing what they were supposed to do. They're going to say that their biggest disappointment, their biggest screw came directly from the public, because it's been the case over and over and over and over and over. I mean, whether it's Fred Whitehurst, real whistleblower from the FBI, blowing the whistle on the FBI forensic department, and you will find this, you know, this really solid real whistleblowers. Now, in the case of this Vanity Fair article, as I said, two of those witnesses, insiders, FBI agents, I had to go convince them. I was like, you know, it's not only you. There's me. There is this particular person. Please, you know, and they're promising they're going to keep your name off the record. And they said, it's going to be futile. I said, no, but this is mainstream, and this is 1.5 million circulation. And they did. They did listen to me. And in 2006 comes, 1 year after that, Hastert gets reelected again, okay? Nobody covers the case. And of the 1.5 million people who did see the article and read it, and it's a damning article, even though it's pretty limited, it's a damning article. No reaction. You know, what one guy said, God damn these Americans. And he's an American, okay? I mean, he was fuming. He was saying, guess what? They're going to fuck themselves. Those were his words, okay? It was the fact that we do this. Okay, now you're really getting me started here. We always say, look at the media. We point finger. You see my finger here in the camera. It's the media. It's the media, corporate media. And then we point finger people. It's the Congress. Congress. Look at those crooks, criminals, despicable people. It's them. We point fingers. George Bush. It's Hillary Clinton. It's we keep pointing finger to these few and at the top. We never look inward. We really don't look at ourselves and our role in all this and our responsibility in all this, because there are hundreds of instances where the information, where the facts, everything had hit them in the face. Yet, they have not shown that that spine, that responsibility of acting upon those, okay? And we have talked about it, James, with Peter as well. We have talked about apathy, learned helplessness, fear, be terrorism, etc. I'm personally, that's for me, coming to this realization that we are past, we are way beyond that. It's beyond apathy. It's beyond moral ambiguity. We have, as society, have in here, and to a certain degree elsewhere, we have reached this level of what I call moral decay, okay? People would say, why sometimes Sibel throws irrelevant examples? I have a daughter. I was looking at the report, GAO report, government report. 15% of the children 6 to 14 going to public schools get to be molested and or raped while in a school, okay? While in a school, they get raped. They get molested by either a janitor or a teacher or a coach like Dennis Hester. There are plenty of those. All sorts of pedophile. And the report, GAO report, says the number should is higher than this because these are only reported cases. You have so many cases of unreported cases, especially when you look at disadvantaged areas, poor areas, black areas, Hispanics. Where are they going to go? They don't even, some of them, know the language to go and report it, okay? So you have that. Then I read this report that came out everywhere about close to 30% of women going to college and universities in this country, they get raped, okay, during their university years. And even if you throw 10% of the cases, say they are maybe frivolous, etc., you look at all these things. Then you look at a congressman who is screwing children. Then you're looking at some congressmen who are stealing from people. Then you're looking at the congressman who is fucking his page. And then you say, well, hold on a second. I mean, it's in a way representative, isn't it? Isn't it representative? At least they are representing some people, because the percentage of these incidents are not low. Is that why people are not reacting? Because then it hits really close to home. Because look at what we are doing in our own daily lives. Look at us. I mean, really look at us. And look at our moral decays, the signs of moral decays we are showing every day. And then say, maybe it is, in this case, it's bottom up. Maybe this is one of those instances of bottom up. And then I'm going to let you just tell me that I'm being totally negative and people are not really that responsible. Everybody's making them do these things, you know. Everybody's making them doing these things. Peter.
The one issue that I have is why did they wait until now to pounce on Hastert? And it could be that Hastert is a sacrificial lamb. After all, he's an ex-member of Congress, ex-speaker. If you're going to get somebody who's not in a position of authority now. And it could be based on some other incidents that have taken place within the last few years. Now, last year, the chief of staff for Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, a guy named Ryan Loskarn, was arrested at his townhouse on Capitol Hill with a hard drive containing literally gigabyte after gigabyte of child pornographic still photos and videos. Now, this was much too much material for him to be, you know, I hate to use the word enjoying by himself. It's clearly this guy was a distributor to others. However, Ryan Loskarn, rather than being kept in protective detention in the District of Columbia, was released in the to the recognizance of his parents in Maryland, and like a few days before his arraignment in D.C. federal court, he was found hanging in his parents' basement, dead. There was no autopsy done by the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland, he just said, "Oh yeah, that's the thing around the neck is kind of indicative of the fact that he hanged himself." That was it. No toxicology, no nothing. Visual exam. Now, Loskarn had also been chief aide to several members of the House of Representatives during the time Hastert was there, and so the issue is, was Loskarn distributing this material to others? And, you know, the way the FBI operates, and Sibel knows this more than anybody, is they'll get a guy like a Loskarn and then say, look, you know, we can shave some time off. You're going to get a heavy sentence, but if you cooperate with us and tell us who were the customers, who were you distributing this to, you know, we'll go relatively easy on you. Because it's the same way they go after mob people. They get the low level to rat out the higher ups. Now, this was going on at the same time the Democratic Attorney General in Pennsylvania, Kathleen Kane, was aggressively pursuing the Jerry Sandusky Penn State matter. And that was a much larger than anyone has reported, because it was all through the Second Mile Foundation, which was basically Sandusky's charity for troubled youth, and it was being used as a pimping service to pimp out young underage boys to big donors to the Second Mile Foundation. Unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, they put this guy Joe Paterno up on a pedestal like he's a god. Well, you know, he's dead. The Graham Spanier, who was the Penn State president, is under indictment now for covering up the Sandusky matter. He had been before that, he had been the president of the University of Nebraska in Lincoln during the time of the Franklin scandal. So there are connections to all these things if you look hard enough. And Kathleen Kane, the attorney general, is trying to run her out of office now. Because she has uncovered the fact that the attorney general office, when her Republican predecessor was there and a Republican governor who was there, they were actually not only covering up and dragging their feet on investigating the Sandusky matter, but they were exchanging lewd emails, including photographs that were highly suggestive of child pornography, not pornography, but suggestive of it. And one of the people who was a recipient and sender of this was a Republican appointee on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who had to resign in disgrace over this. So the fact is, why did they get Hastert now? The Loskarn deal, we don't know. That, by the way, the Loskarn thing was international. It was based out of Toronto, the Ring. And we had the sudden resignation of the Canadian foreign minister and an indictment of a leading member of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, all identified as, well, we don't know about the foreign minister, but he had already been accused of hanging around underage kids. I'm talking about John Baird. Of course, but the Tories have been thrown out, so he got out before the rest of them got thrown out of office. But it's quite clear that Loskarn matter and the Sandusky ring may have had connections, and I've been told it was connected not only around the country and in Canada, but around the world. So possibly Hastert is a sacrificial lamb. They may have gotten his name as associated with some of these other investigations, and they say, "Well, look, we gotta get somebody, but let's end it right there." And of course now he's pleading out in Chicago. So we won't ever get the details, because it's going to be one of these deals where he and the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is a very corrupt office in Chicago, by the way, what they did to George Ryan and Rod Blagojevich, and You know, I mean, they're not, I know they're not sympathetic figures, but this was a case of selective political prosecution. So that is a very corrupt U.S. Attorney's office in Chicago. But that's where he's facing justice. And I don't think we're going to see any kind of full disclosure. They're going to probably fine him, give him maybe, hopefully they won't give him community service working with youth.
Well, and for me, one of the big unanswered questions is why the so-called individual A, who received the money from Hastert in exchange for keeping quiet about the alleged sexual activity 30 years ago, individual A is not being indicted. So that suggests that the cash for silence agreement is considered legal by the FBI and the Justice Department, and they're only tripping up Denny on the structured withdrawal of cash, which, of course, was tightened up under the Patriot Act that he championed and rammed through the Congress. So I find it curious that the very narrow focus of this prosecution and the implication that the recipient of the hush money committed no crime.
Well, I'm going to offer a fairly informed theory on what took place here, because Hastert's case, this recent scandals, what we have, didn't start with the Justice Department. What happened, it started as a much smaller case based on a tip by a guy who was suing Hastert in civil court in a much lower level Chicago politics in Illinois, okay? And those people in lower level, as they started going through the discovery and the case, they started finding these nuggets. And by the time the case came to the attention of the Justice Department, both here and also in Illinois, by here I mean Washington, D.C., I'm no longer there. I'm like here, but I'm not there. It was too late. So they came in, this is the Justice Department, Illinois, totally ordered by the DOJ here in Washington, D.C., to contain the case. So because by then, you have all these clerks, you have all these attorneys finding out about these, they had to do something. So they went ahead and did it in a contained fashion. This is why you are seeing the case limited, Peter, because they being Department of Justice and the FBI, they don't want to see this case going into trial. It's going to be twice worse for the government, for the DOJ and the FBI. It also involves past, you know, former and present power people in Illinois. You're looking at big, big names, current and past, okay? And you're looking at a White House. You're looking at Obama from Chicago. Dennis Hastert's case from the late 1990s, early 2000 involves people like Rahm Emanuel, okay? It involves people like Bob Creamer with his dirty wife, Jan Schakowsky, in Congress. Jan Schakowsky has been paid, she's being paid by Mullah Fethullah Gulen that we have been discussing here, the CIA's $20 billion Islamic Foundation, which is centered in Chicago. So neither the federal government, the DOJ, FBI, nor the White House, nor the government in Illinois would dare taking this case to courts. Does Hastert notice? Yes. Does his attorney, defense team notice? Absolutely. So now we have this completely fake discussions, because they already know they're not going to let this go into court, right? Between the government and Hastert. And both parties want to look good, meaning it has to look good. Look at the judge he got. The judge he got, this corrupt SOB, this judge has been not only donating money to Hastert in the past, okay? His brother is the top leader of GOP, the current judge, who is residing in Hastert's case, okay? This judge used to work with Hastert's son, who's a partner in this law firm, okay? And Hastert's son at the time was working for Dick Cheney. Nobody is going to let this case to go to trial. It's not going to be only horrible, bad for Hastert. He only has a few years to live. Most likely he's going to crash in the middle of all this. And then the case will totally, permanently will go away. But you're looking at people in the Justice Department, FBI, Chicago politics, Obama, Rahm Emanuel. You're looking at dozens of people in Congress being implicated in this case, okay? And it's not going to happen. And all this stuff are BS, this plea deal, and that the fact that they are negotiating. So the case didn't start with them trying to go and make an example, when the case started by this guy in 2011 going and bringing lawsuit against Hastert and starting with some lower court in Chicago. And then by the time it got big, it snowballed. DOJ and the real big people were like, now how are we going to contain it? It's too late to make it disappear. We can't just click the button and say delete, you know? So let's make it a very contained case. This is why, Peter, you're not seeing this individual named. Nobody's talking about bringing charges against this individual. None of the people in the media are talking about a chronic pedophile. He had this much power as a teacher, and he used it to screw minors. He had this much power in Congress, okay? He used it to screw people here domestically, minors, but also overseas. And Wayne, that includes Turkey and Morocco as well, in addition to Southeast Asia. And so that's the real case that the media is complicit, knowingly, not because they don't understand the case, not because they don't have all the factual historical context. And again, that aside, James, I don't know. We need another discussion, I guess, to talk about the people factor in this. And that's the part that concerns me. After 13 years in this journey, whistleblowing, courts, Supreme Courts, Congress, the darn ridiculous thing, petition, voting, etc. I ended all that in 2006, okay? My eyes are now open. They have been open. The U.S. media, what they have done, is no surprise to me. Of course it's not. The biggest surprise for me is having this opportunity with the internet, okay, with these mediums like YouTube currently, and with the social channels, being able to communicate directly with people, bypassing the government, bypassing the media, and yet seeing this lack of reaction, lack of interest, and lack of understanding of implications, okay? Because I'm going to leave you with this, and I'm going to have you end this, because they have this thing, Washington's blog covered this, 90% plus people in U.S., they regard Congress as lower than cockroach. Did you read those headlines? The vote of confidence in Congress is less than 10%. American people, you talk to them, 90%+ they will say they are criminal, crooks, dirty, scumbags, blah, blah, blah. No surprise, nothing new here, folks. God, just go on. Okay, I accept all that. Then 50% of the population age of voting, they go and vote. There is some discrepancy here, folks, okay? We can't have 50% of voting age people voting when 90%+ of people consider them thieves, pedophiles, crooks, scumbags. There is something wrong here. Either you don't vote and say, these people, they come, the authoritarians, we have nothing to do, we don't select them. Or if you're voting and saying that you accept that they are pedophiles and crooks and scumbags and douchebags, okay, then there's something wrong with us. That's the part that they are not going to the step two and three. And that's what we need to talk about. That's what we need to address. We can talk about the media. We are finished talking about the U.S. media. Done, okay? We are finished talking about U.S. Congress and the presidents and Bush and Obama. Done. Right now, my biggest problem, my biggest issue is what we're going to do, people, ourselves, about our kids, about our lives, about the way we live our lives, about the way we have principles, about our own morals, okay? Moral values. What are we about, really? What are we about? That was my last sentence.
Well, that's a pretty powerful and stirring way to end things, and I hate to leave the tapestry of this conversation with a hanging thread, but that is obviously too much of a conversation to broach at this point, so we will wrap things up here. I will only, as a teaser to our next conversation on this topic, I will only say that I tend to disagree that it is moral decay that we are facing. I think it is moral desensitization, and I think there's a couple of different ways that applies, both to the mainstream audience and to the alternative media audience, and it is it is surprising, it is disappointing, but you can almost hear a pin drop in the comment section of my video on Hastert, for example. No one cares. No one cares. We all know pedophiles are in Congress. No one cares. Why is that? And we're not going to do anything about it. We're going to continue to vote, and we're going to continue the whole charade. It is a very important question, but we'll cover that, as I say, in our next conversation. This conversation never really ends, does it? It just continues going on. All right, let's wrap things up properly. We're joined today once again by Wayne Madsen of the Wayne Madsen Report, waynemadsenreport.com, Peter B. Collins, peterbcollins.com, and Sibel Edmonds of boilingfrogspost.com. I'm your host, James Corbett of corbettreport.com. Until next time, thank you for tuning in, and please do check the show notes for links to some of the stories and ideas that we've been talking about. Thank you for your time.